You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto, and for the rest of the hour, we're going to talk about efforts to combat HIV/AIDS. The researchers have known since the mid-90s that people with certain genes are far less likely to become infected with HIV if they're exposed to the virus. HIV enters through cells through a receptor, sort of a gateway. All kinds of research has been going on about studying these cells, studying these gateways. Also, there's a lot of basic research that's going on in looking for new vaccines. And there's actually a clinical trial of a vaccine that is just getting underway. And I want to talk about that with my guest, Dr. Sarah Schlesinger, who is research associate professor at the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center and at Rockefeller University in New York. And here she joins us in our studios in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, this just began this month, this study,
yes,
right?
Yes, actually, it began. We've just begun screening last week.
Really?
Yeah, we're just.
When you say screening, tell us what you mean by that.
What that means is that patients or subjects come in and volunteer, and the most important thing that we have to do is determine if they're eligible from our perspective and go through the process of informed consent and make mm-hmm. sure that they truly understand what's involved and that they want to participate. And part of being eligible from our perspective is a series of blood tests and laboratory assessments. And so we do that. And then once that's done, we enroll the patients, and then they actually receive the vaccine.
And how many patients are we talking about?
Well, this is a small phase 1 study, and it will be 48 patients total, 30 of them at the Rockefeller and the remainder at Rochester, University of Rochester in Rochester. Mm-hmm. So it's a small phase 1 study.
It's almost like flying under the radar screen. hardly anybody's heard about it. It should be big news.
Well, we think it's big news. we're
but
very
there have been
excited.
There have been vaccines that have failed in the past.
Yes. Well, one of the great challenges in developing a vaccine for HIV/AIDS is that the only way to know if one works is to take it full to an efficacy study. Mm-hmm. There's been one full efficacy study done, and that was done by Vaxgen, and unfortunately that vaccine, as you say, failed. The study was done extremely well and proved that it was possible to do it, but the product didn't protect.
Yeah.
So
what makes you think this one is going
to
work?
Well, I like to say I'm cautiously optimistic.
Yeah.
I think it's highly unlikely that this one is going to make us done, that we're going, you know, that this is going to protect everybody well enough that we're going to be done with this effort. However, what we're hoping is that this is going to be an incremental step in moving forward and that it may protect a proportion of people. And if that happens, then we will have information on what it takes to protect, and that will move the field forward in a way that's hard to describe. Because right now, we have 5 vaccines in the laboratory. One of them could work, and we have no way of knowing. We can do animal studies, and that gives us some information. We can do some in vitro studies in the laboratory, that gives us some information, but we don't know.
Yeah.
And if I give you a tetanus shot, I can draw your blood 2 weeks later and measure neutralizing antibody and say, you're protected. And that way, if I have a new tetanus shot, it's really easy to tell if it's better. We don't have, it's called a correlate of protection.
Right.
We don't have that for HIV. So if we...
Well, what do you mean you don't have that?
We don't know. Nobody's ever been protected by a vaccine. So we don't know what we need to measure to tell if somebody's protected. We have some pretty good ideas, but we don't really know.
This is just a shot in the dark. This is what we used to call brute force method.
Well,
you just try one thing after another after another?
You raise a very interesting question. Most vaccine development for all vaccines has been done by what's referred to as the empiric method, which is what you call brute force, mm-hmm. which is trying something and hoping it works.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, as we discussed, that hasn't worked for HIV to date. So what we aspire to be doing and hope we're doing, as our colleagues are, is doing what's called rational vaccine design, which means not just using brute force, but being informed by the work we do in the laboratory, by the work we do in our animal models, to make something better and move forward, not just empirically, let's try this and see. Because let's try this and see, 23 years later, has left us where we are today.
So what you say, you don't expect this to work fully.
Right.
What would be a sign of success, then, in this?
Well, let me step back. I, in my wildest dreams, hope that maybe it will work well enough that we'll be done and I can go home and bake cookies. However, I think it's highly unlikely. But what we're hoping is that we'll protect a proportion of people. or it will protect people from disease, if not infection. So ideally, we want a vaccine to provide sterilizing immunity, which would mean to prevent infection with the virus. However, if it were to prevent disease so that people who encountered the virus did not develop AIDS, that would be huge. And even most vaccines, you know, the sort of figure you'd like to have protected is 90%. But what if it protects 50 or 60%? That, too, would be huge.
And that would tell you, by comparing the two different populations who were protected and weren't, which direction to go.
Exactly, because we could measure various parameters in the bloodstream of those people who were protected and say, ah, this correlates with protection. And then we would have the correlate that we need to move forward and tell if a vaccine was better without having to do an efficacy trial.
Yeah. You know, we've heard over the years that vaccine trials were going to happen in Africa, places where there are giant epidemics, millions of people dying. This is happening in New York.
Right. Well, that's because this is a phase one trial. So for any vaccine to be licensed by the FDA or really any other regulatory authority, there are three phases of testing. Mm-hmm. Phase one, which is primarily safety. Phase two, which is immunogenicity, where you look to see if you're eliciting the sort of immune response for which we hope. And then phase three, which is the efficacy or field trial that I mentioned earlier. This is a phase one trial. Though we're formally looking at safety, we're also going to look at immunogenicity. We wouldn't go through the effort of and ask people to volunteer if we were going to not look at how it was working. But this vaccine is ultimately destined to be tested in China, we hope. It's based on a clade C isolate that was isolated in Kunming in Yunnan province. And it's not only the strain that's circulating in China, but also the strain that's circulating in India and large parts of southern Africa.
It's a major strain.
It's a major strain. Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh. And how long does the test take? I mean, how long would you have to follow people?
Well, that's a very good question. The trial will take 18 months from the time a person enrolls till the time they're done. But the process of phase one to phase two to phase three, the figure that's generally quoted is 10 years. We're optimistic that we can move much faster than that. Mm. And one of the reasons that we can move faster with phase one has been one of the really nice surprises with this. Common wisdom is it's very hard to get people to come forward and volunteer. We've been overwhelmed by people volunteering. And so the original plan was for this to take, it could have taken up to a year or two to enroll, but because the way people of New York have been coming forward, will be enrolled within 5 months.
Wow, yeah, New Yorkers do volunteer.
New Yorkers are amazing. I've
been following this for 25 years, and I've seen, absolutely.
Yeah.
But don't you face sort of you'll be watching then to see how many more people get infected whether or not the AIDS, the HIV is spreading? Is that how you know whether it's working?
Well, in this part of the trial, the phase one trial, yeah, is not designed to tell if the vaccine is working in that way. We'll tell if it's safe, and we'll see if people are making responses, cellular immune responses and antibody responses. Mm-hmm. We are looking for low-risk seronegative people, so people who are not infected with HIV and who aren't likely to become infected in the course of the trial. As we move forward in development and we move into the further phases of testing, that will change. And then in a phase three trial where we can determine efficacy, then you go into a population of people, almost always overseas, and you see how many people are getting infected. Then you provide clean needles, condoms, education to lower infection rates because it's the ethical thing to do. And then you come back and you ask people to volunteer. You vaccinate, after informed consent, some with your vaccine and half or a third with placebo. And then you follow them for a year to 3 years. If all of your infections occur in the placebo group, you know your vaccine worked. If your infections are equally distributed, it didn't. And if it's something in between, then we're faced with what we talked about earlier, where you have partial protection.
Right. Of course, if you go into a region of the world where they're practicing safe sex, you're going to have trouble proving. I mean, if they're using condoms correctly,
could
it be disguised?
If only it were so. Unfortunately, prevention, condoms, and safe sex, though absolutely essential, and the only thing we really have to offer in terms of prevention currently, doesn't work as well as one might hope. Human nature being what it is, it lowers infection rates, but not to the point where we can't do vaccine trials.
Well, I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk with
us. Well, thank you very much for having me.
Sarah Schlesinger is Research Associate Professor at the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center at Rockefeller University, and she was with us here in New York. Now we're going to move on to continue talking about AIDS and infections and a couple of studies. There's some interesting studies out this week about how AIDS may spread and how it might be influenced by your genetic makeup. You know, we hear about the genes being important in all kinds of diseases. We're just finally learning now about how your gene makeup may be important in the spread of HIV and your an infection. Researchers have known since the mid-90s that people with certain genes are far less likely to become infected with HIV if they're exposed to the virus. HIV enters cells through a receptor, a sort of a gateway called CCR5. We each have two copies of the CCR5 gene, one from each of our parents. And people with two mutated or defective copies of the gene have almost complete resistance to HIV. Interesting research point here. And last week, researchers reported that having multiple copies of a different gene called CCI3L1 also gives a measure of resistance. So are there other genes that might be at work? How can this information be used to develop better treatments or vaccines? Joining me now to talk about that finding and how it fits in with what we know about CCR5 are the two lead researchers. Dr. Sunil Ahuja is a professor of medicine, microbiology, and immunology at the University of Texas Health Science Center. He is also director of the VA HIV-AIDS Center there. He joins us from the studios of Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Thank you for being with us today, Dr. Ahuja.
Good afternoon. Thank you for being here.
Good afternoon to you. Also there with Dr. Ahuja at Texas Public Radio is U.S. Air Force Colonel and Medical Doctor Matthew Dolan. He's the director of the Defense Institute for Medical Operations at the Brooks City Base in San Antonio. Thank you for being with us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Let me begin with you. Why did you look at the – tell us about this specific gene, the CCR5, and how it works and why you looked at it.
Well, CCR5, as you indicated, was earlier described as one of the important gateways for the entry of HIV, and that – observation really was born to fruit by that observation you said, which is that when individuals have two defective copies of this, they don't express CCR5 on the cell surface, and that affords pretty much very high resistance to it. So that is somewhat forms like a lock, if you will, and for the entry of the virus or a gateway. And then these keys, which are like the chemokines, if you will, which interact with this receptor. And some very seminal studies earlier done actually from some investigators back at Iron Diamond, like Dr. Kaup and all, had shown that individuals that are highly exposed to the virus but resist the virus, actually their cells make a large amount of these chemokines. Mm-hmm. And another seminal study by Dr. Gallo and his colleagues in Italy and with Zaguri had shown that actually hemophiliacs who had received tainted blood and some of these individuals, hemophiliacs, had resisted the virus, and their blood cells again produced a large amount of chemokines that interacted with CCR5. So CCR5 are these soluble immune molecules that interact with CCR5, and then the hypothesis would be that individuals who had low amounts or who innately produced low amounts of these chemokines would be more susceptible to virus. And then so other investigators, including Dr. Gallo and others, had shown that individuals who produced low amounts of or higher amounts of chemokines had a good clinical outcome. So it was a logical extension of this work to ask whether certain chemokines could influence the susceptibility to HIV and AIDS. And we took a genetic approach to examine this problem. And the chemokine that we focused on is actually IRS called CCL3L1. And it's a very potent ligand for CCR5, or an immune molecule that interacts with one of the most potent ones of them. And by virtue of that, it actually has fairly significant anti-HIV properties in vivo, so like a natural anti-HIV substance in the body.
Let me just have to break in and just remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday from NPR News. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So the way we examined this then was to basically ask if individuals who had variations in the gene that produces a chemokine called CCL3L1, whether that influenced their risk for HIV-AIDS susceptibility. And as you pointed out, most of us have two copies for most genes, or two alleles. In this case, this gene is actually a different kind of variation, and most people, most investigators look at changes in what we call the DNA alphabet soup of the A, C, T, or G, the nucleotides that we call them. In this case, this is a different kind of variation where we're talking about differences in the dosage of a gene. And so CCL3L1 gene copy numbers vary among individuals. And we screened large populations of individuals and found that individuals who possess low copy numbers of this gene are have a higher predisposition to acquiring infection. And once infected, their rates of progression.
Let me see if I can translate for the lay people. This is a large mouthful of stuff that very few of us understood, but I'll see if I can translate it for us, for you. In other words, if you have a large amount of CC3L1, it floods the receptors and blocks HIV from getting in. Would that, in a few words, sum up what you've said? If you have the genes, you have a lot of copies of this gene, you make a lot of this chemokine, as you called it, it goes into the lock, it keeps that lock shut and prevents the AIDS virus from entering the cell. So what you want to do is maybe make something that can help flood the receptors for HIV?
That would be a simple way of putting it. That would be correct. I mean, it would be like trying to find an analogous version that could do the same thing that the natural version does.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Dolan, how easy would it be then to come up with some sort of some sort of gene therapy that might be able to replace the genes and put the ones in that you'd need there?
Well, you know, Ira, it's a different thing to really look at what happens in nature and then project that out toward an intervention. Sometimes it would work and sometimes it would not work. I think that what I would say regarding this study is that what we got insight into is that, at least in nature, this is one of the factors that helps to really differentiate what protects people in nature from being infected. And then once infected, what helps to influence the rate at which they get sick.
Mm-hmm. And so you're not talking about any therapy here. You're talking about just understanding the mechanism.
Well, yes, in some respects, it goes back to what Sarah was indicating earlier, that, you know, we really don't understand completely the immune correlates of protection. And what we've really done is to be able to link these genetic markers potentially to two different risk categories, individuals who are highly susceptible, individuals who are resistant or partially resistant. And by trying to understand their immune makeup that's linked to these genetic factors can be quite important.
All right, we're going to have to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about HIV/AIDS and the genetic link. Take your calls, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-8255. Talk. We'll be right back after the short break. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking about the genetic basis of HIV/AIDS and why some people may be susceptible to becoming infected. What is there about their genetic makeup that allows some people to be almost immune from becoming infected? And where scientists are telling us that they're finding these genetic differences in people that account for these differences, and sometimes there are multiple differences in people, and they vary from person to person. I want to bring on now someone who's studying the genetic differences, not in humans, but our closest relatives, some of our closest relatives, the rhesus monkeys. Some of them, they're completely immune from HIV infection. Wow, that's amazing. Why should they be immune? They're very close to us genetically. What is there about their genes that makes them immune and not us? Well, researchers in the UK this week report that just a single change in one gene, and it's a gene shared by humans and monkeys, a single change protects rhesus monkeys from the HIV virus. And we humans, that gene protects against other retro infections, like retrovirus infections, but not HIV. So joining me now to talk more about this work is Jonathan Stoy. He is the head of the Division of Virology at the Medical Research Council of the National Institute for Medical Research in the UK. He joins us by phone from London. Thanks for staying up late for us.
It's good to be talking to you.
Tell us about the rhesus monkey is naturally immune from HIV infection.
That's right. There have been a number of attempts over the past few years to develop good models for AIDS, and primates were one possible model. And it was found that HIV grows very poorly in most primates if you try and introduce it. And from studies like this, it became clear that there was a gene in monkeys that was very good at blocking the infection of HIV. And studies by Joe Sadrowski last year showed that this was a gene called TRIM5, that you have the monkey TRIM5 gene, it works fine to block HIV replication, the human gene does not. What we've been doing is to examine the difference between the two, and what we can show is that a single amino acid difference between the monkey and human genes gives this difference in behavior of the genes. So the monkey genes are completely resistant, or the monkeys are resistant, we are not.
One single amino acid can do it.
That's what we're saying.
Is it possible down the road someplace to change that amino acid in people so that we would have that immunity?
I think thoughts of germline gene therapy are somewhat beyond the scope of this program. But we could
The thoughts are not beyond the scope of the program. The completion of it, I think.
what we could contemplate, however, yeah. is somatic cell gene therapy, trying to introduce a gene of the modified kind back into human lymphocytes and trying to develop within HIV-infected individuals populations of resistant cells which would block progression to frank AIDS.
Mm-hmm. Could it be that there are humans that might have this mutation, we simply just don't know about them?
We've never looked. I think, however, it's unlikely. We're doing phylogenetic studies of the evolution of this gene in a variety of different monkeys and apes. Others have done similar studies. It looks as though within the great apes, within our closest relatives, they've all changed.
Yeah.
So compared to the rhesus monkey. So it's unlikely, it's possible, but it's unlikely that humans will prove to have resistance markers at one of these loci.
All right, so what do you do with this information that you've discovered? How can we make practical use out of it?
We're making a number of proposals, one of which is that we might think about gene therapy, trying to introduce a resistant form of the human gene into our cells. Another would be to try to develop drugs that might alter the behavior of the current human gene and make it now recognize HIV.
Very interesting. I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us today, Dr. Stoy.
Thank you.
Good luck to you. Jonathan Stoy, head of the Division of Virology at the Medical Research Council at the National Institute for Medical Research in the UK. He was on the phone with us from London. Dr. Schlesinger, you've been listening. What do you think?
Well, I think both of the discoveries that have been discussed are fascinating and help us to understand how the virus interacts with the host. That in itself is cool and interesting, but as a fairly practical person and as a physician, for me, what I'm thinking is, you know, how can we use this? How can we take this information and move forward into making a difference? And I think that there are two important ways to think about that. And the first one is, as Dr. Stoy said, can you pharmacologically or through genetic therapy mimic either of these conditions? Can we learn from what nature has done and extend that, particularly for people who are already infected? And those are, you know, understanding it and then implementing it, it's a huge difference. But as you said, thinking about it's the first step. And there are ways that that can be done. The other thing that I think that for me in a more sort of down-to-earth practical way is historically vaccine protection or the ability to prevent a disease has been based in understanding how people naturally fight it off. And those are usually immune mechanisms. And what we're looking to do is to trigger an immune mechanism. But understanding the other mechanisms and how populations of people are protected or partially protected, as Matt Dolan was saying, leads us down that road. It's unlikely that we're going to do anything immunologically to induce a change in TRIM5 alpha. I mean, that's hard to imagine. On the other hand, studying how the immune systems of those people are different from those of us, you know, how the monkeys are different, mm-hmm. or the immune systems of the cohort that was studied in Texas are different, if there's an immunologic correlate to having this genetic difference,
Tell us what that would
well,
be, for example.
What that might mean is that if their T cells, so you have
those
two,
are like
white blood cells. And so of the white blood cells that fight off viruses,
right.
there are T cells, T cell lymphocytes, and B cell lymphocytes. B cell lymphocytes make antibody or antisera. That's particularly important in preventing infection. In actually eliminating either a cancer cell or a virally infected cell, most people believe that T-cell lymphocytes and those that bear CD8 are particularly important. Mm-hmm. And we see that in the lab all the time, and, mm-hmm. and that's, I think, pretty for sure. If those cells are functioning differently, if they're making different chemokines or different cytokines that can be measured, and we can say, those that kill the virus, those that kill the virally infected cells do this, then if we measure that in people who are administered a vaccine, perhaps that will lead us to understand better how to monitor our vaccines, how the immune correlates might lead us more expeditiously and more mm-hmm. more speedily down the road to a vaccine that works.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Dolan, might there be other genes that we have not discovered that are important in the infection process here?
Well, there's no question that this is one step in a long journey, and it explains some of the variation that accounts for differences in susceptibility and differences in disease outcome. But it's, again, one step on the journey. It might be helpful, though, when we look at vaccines that have a weak effect, if we can account for some of that difference between individuals to level the ground a little bit and be able to detect a vaccine with a weak signal, and at least start at that point then and say, okay, this vaccine works a little bit, right, and we can detect it because we reduce or we improve that signal-to-noise ratio by accounting for genetic variation.
Mm-hmm. And we're getting to that era where we're going to be tailoring drugs to certain genetic variations in people.
Absolutely.
Well, or perhaps even hopefully down the road, as we understand more about the differences in terms of how quickly people progress with their HIV, maybe we can look toward a time where we can tailor the timing of starting therapy, start some people later or start some people earlier.
1-800-989-8255. David in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, David.
Hi. My question is, you mentioned that this vaccine is most effective against a certain strain of HIV, which is common in China, India, et cetera. If you're testing this in New York, how high of incident rate do you have of this particular strain, and how effective is this testing protocol going to be, number one? And number two, if you're testing a low-risk group, how effective is this going to be, this protocol, since that's another consideration?
Dr. Schlesinger?
Well, you raised two very good points. And the first one is, we are testing this in New York in low-risk individuals. This is phase one testing. The goal of this phase of the testing is simply to establish safety data in humans and immunogenicity data. We have no expectation and we have no way of measuring if this is going to be effective. In fact, we are intentionally selecting people and asking them to be sure that they engage in all of the safer sex practices, et cetera, to protect against getting infected. The other question you ask, I think, is a more interesting one and one that I didn't touch on earlier, and that is, this is based on an isolate that was isolated, as I said, in Kunming, China, in the Yunnan province. We don't know if the great diversity of HIV genetically is going to require different vaccines. The ideal would be if one vaccine would protect against all strains. That's an ideal, and it seems highly unlikely to most of us in the field that that will be the case. The easiest immunologic way to protect is the same virus, the vaccine based on the virus that the individual is going to encounter. That's called a homologous challenge. A heterologous challenge is where your vaccine strain is different from the virus you're going to encounter. We need to test that hypothesis. We need to answer that question. But we want to stack the deck in our favor in the beginning. As Dr. Dolan said, you know, if we have a weakly effective vaccine, we want to do the best we can to see if it's working at all. So therefore, we're working to match the strain of the vaccine to what's called the circulating strain in the area in which we'll ultimately test it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. Dr. Hooja, you're looking at how many strains of HIV that you looked at? Was it one main strain?
Yes, this is the clade B strain that's infecting most of the population that we've examined, which is a cohort of the U.S. Air Force and children who were from Argentina, who were exposed to the virus by virtue of their mothers being all HIV positive.
Mm-hmm. Talking about AIDS, HIV this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. It's been, how many years now? 1981, AIDS has been around for...
Right, 23 years.
23 years
that
we know
since
of.
We've known of we've it. Known I think it. Realistically probably at least... at least 10 before that it was probably circulating, and maybe even a little more.
And it outsmarts us all the time.
It does seem that way. It does seem that way. However, I think it's important to sort of, not only see what we need to do, but how far we've come in terms of drug therapy. I mean, I was an intern in the mid-80s in the Bronx in the midst of the epidemic. And at that point in this country, it was a death sentence. And young people were coming in and they were dying before our eyes. Now my colleagues at the Aaron Diamond, Marty Markowitz and Dr. Ho, my boss, who treat in seropositive people with drugs and who've worked out how to use the antiretrovirals, people are getting one or two pills a day and leading normal lives and really are dealing with a chronic disease, not a death sentence. Mm-hmm. And that change is it's not to be underestimated. And Matt, I mean, I know you've seen more of it than I have. I mean, it's nothing short of a miracle. The problem is, for one, the drugs are not perfect. And for two, 95% of the epidemic is in the developing world where most people don't have access to the drugs.
Well, there are people critics have said, you should have gone after the vaccine first instead of the treatment.
Yes.
Then we might be further along with the rest of the world.
Absolutely. And I have to tell you that if asked, I might say the same thing. I'm obviously biased. I'm an immunologist and a vaccinologist. But... one of the things that we have to do in developing a vaccine is work on what's called distributive justice, which means getting the drugs that we do have to the people who need them the best way we can as we're working on a vaccine. But I think one of the good news is one of the places that we've moved forward is there was a lot of, not a lot of attention paid to vaccines even 10 years ago. And that's changed in the last decade. And certainly... there's been a major response by the NIH, a major response by the Gates Foundation. A lot of people who previously, Dr. Ho, my boss, mm-hmm. was engaged in working on drugs, and now in the last 5 years he's turned his attention to vaccines. I think that's all very optimistic.
Mm-hmm. Are these countries that needed the vaccines the most, are they going to be able to afford them if they get made?
In a word, no. We in the developed world are going to have to figure out a way to make them available. Again, this issue of distributive justice. Mm-hmm. I think that there is no question that many of us who are working on these vaccines think very hard about that. Because, for instance, in TB, which costs about $8 a year to treat in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, most people who need those drugs don't get them. Mm-hmm. And putting that infrastructure in place, the ability to deliver the vaccine if we have it, is a non-trivial issue and something that, even though we don't have the vaccine yet, needs serious consideration and attention.
Mm-hmm. Are you optimistic over there? And Dr. Dolan, are you optimistic about we're going to come up with something that will be able to be distributed equitably to everybody?
I think it's a matter of first things first. And, we need to attack this on every front. We need to go after prevention and keep people from getting infected. We need to go after therapy and improve therapy, improve both the toxicity, improve the ease of therapy, improve the distribution of therapy, and we need to go after that noble goal of vaccines. So mm-hmm. attack it on every front. But I think we're getting there. It's a step-by-step process. And even there are benefits that come along the way, and that along the way, basic science has really moved forward a great deal. And there'll be things that we learn about the human body and HIV that help us out in other diseases down the road, too.
Last word, Dr. Ahuja?
Well, I think it's an iterative process. I mean, if you look at acute lymphoblastic leukemia in the mid-50s and 60s, it was a devastating disease, and now it's nearly curable. And that's because of iterative clinical trials that have really come through with it. And I think this is the same process. We need to keep at it and not lose our focus.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank all of you for taking time to talk with us today. Dr. Sunil Ahuja, professor at the University of Texas Health Science Center. Dr. Matthew Dolan is also a colonel and chief of medical operations at the Brooks Air Force Base in San Antonio. And also Dr. Sarah Schlesinger, research associate professor at the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Institute at Rockefeller University. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Our program is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our director and our web producer. Our interns are Corey Binns and Abby Leonard. We talked about a lot of stuff today. If you missed any of it, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. All the links are there. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is up there. We make free teaching curricula based on Science Friday. Great stuff today to use in your classroom. Just click on the teachers button and you can download the teaching material. Also, there's a real audio version of back editions of Science Friday, and you can download Science Friday onto your iPod on audible.com. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.